voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Very good afternoon to you. It's Matt Jolly with you for the next 2 hours, taking a look at what one person described this week as the politics nonsense. I'll tell you exactly what we are doing after we get the latest news from Richard Foster.
Thanks, Matt. Good afternoon. The lawyers for some of the 37 women who've accused Mohamed Al Fayed of rape and sexual assault say the Harrods enabled its former owner. The billionaire who died last year has been described as a monster and a predator. One of the lawyers is Dean Armstrong KC.
Our aim, and our single aim, is to seek justice for the survivors of the sexual abuses of Mohamed Al Fayed, who we say was enabled by an unsafe system of work which Harrods established, maintained, certainly acquiesced to, and we say facilitated during his chairmanship.
Harrods insists the company is very different now, and they've made a settlement process available to women who say they were attacked by Mr. Al Fayed. Well, Mohamed Al Fayed also owned Fulham Football Club. It says it started an investigation into whether anyone there was affected by his behaviour. We'll have more on that story in the next hour. There's been more violence between Israel and Lebanon. The Israeli military says more than 100 rockets have been fired into northern Israel. The attacks follow intensive airstrikes in southern Lebanon. Amin Salam is the Lebanese economy minister.
What we were trying to do as a government to quiet things down, calm things down, and try to get to a peaceful platform was really escalated by this last action that was taken by Israel towards Lebanon. So it makes it more difficult that whenever there's an escalation, a negative one, the result is actually always a response that is more aggressive. And that's the cycle we're trying to get out of.
Official figures show government borrowing rose to £13.7 billion last month. Britain's public sector debt now sits at 100% of the country's economic output. 10 new Welsh words have been added to the Oxford English Dictionary. Harriet Horgan from BBC Wales explains the additions, which include how to say cheers, as well as the word for chips.
Iechyda, achyfi a sglods, some of the Welsh words that have been added to the Oxford Dictionary, which contains more than 500,000 words and is updated 4 times a year. But what else has been added? Mamgi, atadki, gran and grandpa, senedd, parliament, cowl, soup, and kalenig, which is a gift given on New Year's Day.
And hundreds of Sky Glass TV and streaming service customers have been reporting problems. Some of the televisions weren't working properly or even turning on last night, and issues were still being flagged this morning. Sky says customers should manually restart their devices by following a guide on its website. That's the news. Shoujo Sarkar has the sport.
Surrey's cricketers have become the first team in 56 years to win the 3 county championship titles in a row. Their achievement was confirmed this morning after their nearest challenger, Somerset, lost to Lancashire at Old Trafford. English golfer Matthew Baldwin is the clubhouse leader after his second round at the PGA Championship at Wentworth. He carded a 66 today to back up his 65 yesterday, and he's at 13 under par. Baldwin is currently 4 shots clear at the top of the leaderboard. And in Formula One, McLaren are to modify the rear wing they used to win the Azerbaijan Grand Prix after their rivals raised questions about its legality. Governing body, the FIA, initially said the wing, which was seen on television footage flexing at high speed, had passed all the tests and did not require any changes. However, the FIA has since changed its stance after complaints by rivals, primarily Red Bull, and have had conversations with McLaren. You can hear second practice at the Singapore Grand Prix over on Sports Extra right now.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us. Matt Jolly. Listen on BBC Sounds.
I am completely in control.
Go back to your constituencies and prepare for...
Yeah, ignore all the noises off about who paid for my ping pong balls and whether Chris Mason earns more than me. I am completely in control. I'm focused. And every day, the message from me to the team is exactly the same. Is it raining in Salford? No, we have to deliver. We have to deliver is what I keep telling the team, and that's what we're going to do on the show today. Yeah, I was at a big radio thing this week, and somebody said to me, I really like what you do with all that politics nonsense, which it feels like that could be the new slogan for the show. Today, then, we deliver. Reform UK's conference will be live there. They're describing it as the biggest knees up in political history, although they're not using the word knees. There is, though, apparently a limit on 4 alcohol drinks per person when they go to the bar. And doubles count as 2. Also on the show today, the politics of the Tour de France, the art of spinning your way out of a story that just won't go away, and the return of... Oh, hang on, Lindsay, where are you, Lindsay? Oh, here he is.
First past the post.
Thank you, Lindsay. Yes, will our reigning Prime Minister Gordon be defeated by this week's Leader of the Opposition in our hugely popular quiz?
First past the post.
Yes, week 3. It's week 3. It's going to go really well this week. So all that's coming up on the show today between now and 4. But before that, as we like to, on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned on the show this week. We learned the noise that Ed Davey makes on a roller coaster while trying to name all his 72 MPs. We learned that if you run out of things to say at Lib Dem conference, Tony Livesey will come to your rescue.
It's me. It's me and Mariana. Hello.
Tony, are you there? Tony, yeah, thank goodness. Tony, save me. We learned from new Conservative MP Ben Obsidjecty what happened to all his stuff.
We had temporary lockers when we were sort of all sharing workspace before they allocated the offices. And over the course of recess, they emptied them out. And the stuff that was in my locker has gone missing.
We learned from Gomez rock star and Labour candidate Tom Gray. Who are weirder, politicians or musicians?
I mean, it's both sides, really. It's all the neurodiversity Olympics.
We learned from Tory spad Gito Howie what Boris Johnson called Sue Gray.
She was affectionately known at the time as Psycho Sue.
We learned from ex-Labour spad Aisha Hazarika that working in Number 10 isn't all that.
That is like the kind of upper echelons of the world of spaddery. And then what you realise is that Downing Street is one of the most kind of unpleasant, dysfunctional sort of places in the world.
We learned that since 2003, 153 people have donated £4.7 million voluntarily to the Treasury, or as Peter Ruddock explained...
So I make that out as 1,884,624 Maltese chocolate digestives.
We learned from Keir Starmer that everything is totally fine and normal.
Am I completely in control?
And we learned the answer to the question, can Ed Davey sing? All right, turn that off. We want some listeners left, especially as so many people have been in touch saying they'll never listen to the show again, because if you're listening to Breakfast this morning with Wick and Claire, they got me to do their feature In My Opinion, where I voiced my opinion about cats in general and Larry the cat in particular. And it's gone down very badly. Turns out Rick Edwards is a big cat fan. So my plans to try and make friends at Five Live aren't going that well. How dare you, Matt Chorley, lost a listener, mate. Do you have a clue how cruel people can be to cats, says Jacqueline in Keynes. I wasn't suggesting being cruel to them. I was just suggesting that a cat sitting outside a shut door isn't amusing. Please can you remind us of the times of Matt's new show so we can boycott it, said Matt in Derby. Who is this anti-cat fool, said someone else. That basically, the whole show was hijacked by pro-Larry people. So, am I sorry about that? Not really. Get in touch if you want to. 85058 on the text. 08085909693 on the WhatsApps. Now, every Friday we like to spend a bit of time looking in more depth at something that came up during the week, which we didn't really get time to dive into properly. Now, I'm working on a Friday afternoon, but is anyone else? In the US, Amazon this week said workers had to start returning to the office full-time from the start of next year in a move away from home working. But here in the UK, political conversation has been very different. The business secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, says Labour's plans to introduce a default right to flexible working will make staff more motivated and resilient. The education secretary, Bridget Phillipson, said teachers will be able to work from home to do planning and marking rather than teaching, because I don't know how that would work. And then at the Lib Dem conference this week, they were talking about it as well. Flexible working, 4-day week on the agenda. because there was one Lib Dem run council who tried the 4-day week, and they said it worked for them despite opposition from the last Conservative government. So I caught up with Councillor Bridget Smith, the leader of South Cambridgeshire District Council, to ask about the 4-day week that they'd introduced, and Joe Royal, director of the 4-day week campaign. So I asked Bridget to tell me how they came to introduce the measure.
We moved to a 4-day working week model because we had massive problems of recruiting and retaining the staff that we need. And this is a national problem. It's especially acute in areas like South Cambridgeshire that are really expensive to live, where there's a really vibrant private sector. And we couldn't recruit people. If we did recruit them, we lost them to the private sector. So we had tried everything we could in order to make ourselves an attractive employer. And we were still failing to get all the staff we needed, and our agency staff bill was £2 million a year. So we thought we would trial this to see what impact it had on recruitment and retention. And it's, the model is 100% of the work in 80% of the time for 100% of the pay, and actually people work 32 hours a week. Now, the last government took again this. I think Conservatives were just ideologically opposed to the very idea of it. I'm very encouraged that a new Labour government seemed to be far more open-minded about it. And most importantly for me as a council leader, they seem to respect the autonomy of councils to make their own decisions about operational matters and about what works best for their residents and their organisations.
OK, let's bring in Joe Royal, director of the 4-day week campaign. Joe, some people listen to this will be thinking, well, if you can do 100% of your work in 80% of the time, maybe you were not working that hard for the other 20% of the time. How do you balance out the idea that actually, if you could get all your work done more quickly, you could be doing some other work on that fifth day rather than just having a 4-day week?
Yeah, I mean, I can see on the face of it how sometimes it seems counterintuitive, but we've got to remember, people aren't productive all the time in a 9-to-5, 5-day working week. Over a 40-hour week, there's a lot of presenteeism. As the kind of business secretary has said, we have a lot of presenteeism in the British economy. And so what a 4-day working week is about, when you reduce your hours and you maintain pay, is you're working more effectively, more efficiently in 4 days rather than five. You tend to also work better. When you're better rested, when you have a better work-life balance outside of work, you don't also then come back into the workplace more motivated, and you generally perform better in your job. And that's what we've seen from all these trials that have taken place now all over the world.
And were there any downsides or any teething issues, Bridget? Did you have to sort of, coordinate so not everyone was off on a Monday? Or were there any problems in introducing it?
So it's not easy to introduce. We spent 3 months working with all our teams to try and ascertain what worked for each team. So we involved all our employees in finding the solutions to what worked for them in delivering their services. It requires people to work at a far greater level of intensity that actually is not sustainable over 5 days. And we've got a burnout culture in this country. We've got very low productivity. People are working very long hours, and long hours do not lead to increased productivity. So we put a lot of effort into the preparation. We constantly tweaked it over the trial period, and it delivered very, very positive results at the end of the day. But it's not something you go into lightly. You have to invest in it. We're open 5 days a week, and we have quite a lot of emergency services that are available 7 days a week. And in South Cambridgeshire, staff are either off on the Monday or the Friday. But we have full cover for all of our services, all of those 5 days. And actually, we opened our customer contact centre for longer hours as a result of it, because we had well-rested, motivated staff who were able to do that.
And I know, it was almost exactly a year ago, and even before that, Michael Gove, when he was the Secretary of State for local government, was talking about punishing councils who did this, either issuing fines or trying to take money off you. Did that ever come to anything?
So they issued us with what's called a best value notice, and they've required us to submit 200 pieces of raw data every single week on a Monday evening to the government, because I think they wanted to find failure. Now, you know, they obviously didn't do that. So we submitted all this data. It's been quite a task doing that. And I'm sure the government had to employ people to analyze all the data at the other end, because there was a heck of a lot of it. And the fact that we never had any feedback from them at all says to me that they didn't find anything to alarm themselves. The threat of financial penalties still hangs over us at the moment. We haven't heard from the new government that is no longer a fact, you know, is no longer a threat. So I've written to Jim McMahon, the local government minister, and said it would be really helpful to have clarity over whether the new government intends to punish local authorities for trying different working practices. And I look forward to hearing back from him in the near future.
Just finally, Joe Royal, is this a sign of sort of our culture changing, that actually some people, it obviously depends how much you're earning and your personal circumstances, but for some people, a three-day weekend is more valuable than a pay rise. They're actually, because, you know, when Bridget's saying they were struggling to retain people, one way of doing that would be to, you know, put up people's wages, give people a pay rise, but obviously that costs more money. Actually, is there a sort of shift in sort of British working culture of we want a bit more free time rather than necessarily a pay rise to carry on working harder and harder?
I think so, and I think it's also partly a generational thing. You know, I think the kind of younger generation coming through, you know, they don't want to be working in the way they've seen their parents and their grandparents work, you know, where their work is such a dominant part of our lives. And if you look at all the evidence now, you know, people are much happier working 4 days a week. It does really feel like that's where we're headed. You know, we are hopeful that this is going to become the normal way of working in the kind of not too distant future. And I think we also, it's kind of not surprising if you think about how much we do work. You know, the UK works on the longest full-time hours in Europe, for example. And we also have one of the least productive economies. So all these long working hours we're doing, actually, as Bridget was saying, it's making us burnt out and not producing good results for people or the economy.
That's Joe Royal, director of the 4 Day Week campaign, and Bridget Smith from South Cambridgeshire District Council. Well, let's get the other side of the argument on all this. James Cox runs a recruitment agency and joins us now. Hi, James.
Hello there. You okay?
Yeah, very good. Is this a good idea, a 4 Day Week, and giving people more flexible options?
I think it needs to be looked at from an industry by industry basis. I can't see it working across every industry. I do think that there are, unfortunately, knock-on effects for the UK economy, especially if people are going into, say, 4 day working weeks. There's the small businesses that are, you know, like shops, for example, in major cities that are going to lose a significant amount of footfall. There'll be taxi drivers that will lose out on fares, which, you know, overall will contribute to or lose out, sorry, on tax for the UK economy. I think that, as I think the lady mentioned, that the employees are now currently working in a far greater level of intensity. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing either. I think that for some people, it would be better for them to do the same output of work over a 5 day working week than to sort of try and cram it in all in 4 days as well. But I also think as well, depending on the seniority of the person that's doing the 4 day week, could have an impact. I think that students, I know the guy mentioned that, you know, people, the younger generation would prefer 4 day weeks. To be honest, everyone would. Everyone would prefer 4 day weeks.
Everyone would just prefer to do less work.
Exactly.
But it's the idea that you can, is it proven that you do actually get all of the work done in the 4 days? Although over time you end up having to say, we could do with another person.
That's what I think. I don't think that's going to be possible. It's quite interesting that the guy said that the productivity levels are at the lowest in Europe across the UK. I'd be quite interested to see more into that. But then if you say take on these new starters, people that are graduates, you need to train them up, and you're only doing that in 4 days a week. You're then cramming education into them. How would they're not going to learn. They're not going to be able to take that in and stick. I just can't see how it's going to work. And then also from the employer's point of view as well, how are they going to make it work? You know, if they've got someone working on a 4 day working week, but they need to speak to them on a Friday. I know there was a law they're talking about bringing out where you can't talk to your staff.
They've got the right to switch off.
Yeah. So they've got the right to switch off. So you can't talk to them on Friday. So you've got to wait until Monday. The customer service side of it as well. if, you know, you, oh, I can't talk to you now, yeah. I'm off work. How's that going to work? I just can't see how the output's going to be there, and customer satisfaction as well. And also, why would anyone want to set up a business in the UK if it's all for the employees? There's just,
well, I suppose the counter argument, which lots of people have made, is that actually, if you've got happy employees who want to work, then they don't leave, and that's good as well. But I think you're right. That one of the things that's come out a lot is it obviously varies workplace as well. James, really good to speak to James Cox, who runs a recruitment consultancy. Do let us know what you think about that. 85058 on the text. Are you working today? Are you listening to me while you're working? Or are you bunking off? 85058 on the text. 08085909693 on the WhatsApps. And now, as you heard in the news, there's been more violence across the border between Israel and Lebanon today. Around 100 rockets were fired across the border into Israel. When the last few minutes, Israel has carried out a strike on a suburb in the south of Beirut. We're going to keep across the latest developments of that throughout the programme today. And a bit later on in the programme, we're going to speak to Lebanon's ambassador to the UK. That'll be before we hand over to Drive at 4 o'clock. So we'll do that a bit later on in the show. Now, on our follow-up Friday last week, we were talking about Keir Starmer's black hole, the £22 billion black hole that he keeps saying the Labour government was left by the last government. Bad economic news. Today, some good economic news, it seems. A story in the Times, it says they found £10 billion, a budget boost by the Bank of England for the Chancellor. Well, let's speak now to Chris Smythe, the Whitehall editor from The Times, who can tell us what is going on. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Matt.
How big was this sofa that the £10 billion was found down the back of it?
Yes, it is a very complicated way they found this money, but it could potentially be quite a significant boost for Rachel Reeves. £10 billion is an estimate. It will depend on the final numbers from the Office of Budget Responsibility. But when you think that the government's made such a song and dance about a £22 billion black hole, the fact that it could suddenly have £10 billion drop into its lap could make a significant difference to its finances and will lead to pressure from Labour MPs to think, hold on a second, why is it so urgent that we go around cutting all these things that we rather like if this money can suddenly appear like this?
I mean, I suppose a bit like your investments can go up as well as down, your forecasts and found money can go up and down as well, and chancellors need some wriggle room. I suppose we need to remember £10 billion would be a lot of money to you or me in the grand scheme of, was it £1.2 trillion a year that the government spends? It's a decimal place on the spreadsheet, isn't it?
It is, yes. And the argument that the Chancellor makes is, you know, we're going to be prudent. If we do get a boost like this, we will save it in case forecasts change in the future. But I think, you know, many Labour MPs will be slightly frustrated if we have a budget where the Chancellor has sort of £20 billion or so of headroom to spare and say, well, why do we need to keep this buffer zone if it's so urgent to make these £20 billion of cuts? And this kind of move from the Bank of England does mean it's just a bit more likely that there will be a pretty comfortable cushion for the Chancellor, which is obviously helpful, but politically quite difficult when she's saying we actually need to make lots of cuts.
And heading into the Labour Party conference, you're right, this might be good news on the one hand, because Rachel Reeves has a bit of wiggle room. It might mean that from the platform at the conference, Labour Party members, Labour MPs, unions as well, might be making the case to move away from the sort of cuts and austerity that seem to have been on the cards.
Yes, there is a sort of slight sense of weariness amongst some Labour MPs with the relentless misery we've heard from Keir Starmer so far. We are promised a bit more light at the end of the tunnel at the party conferences, but it does seem that tunnel is going to be very long, and certainly going through the budget, it seems like we are going to get more miserable decisions. And a lot of Labour MPs thinking, well, is this actually what my constituencies voted for, and isn't there something we could do that isn't quite so miserable?
And, you know, there's good news, then there's bad news. Figures out today showing that the national debt hit 100% of GDP, so the debt is the same size as the entire British economy for the first time since the 1960s, after the government's borrowing bill overshot forecasts. So reacting to that and news of the £10 billion budget boost, we can hear a clip now from the Treasury Minister, James Murray, speaking about the story of £10 billion being found. Let's take a listen.
Well, look, any commentary about what the Bank of England has said is pure speculation at this stage. The fiscal forecast will be set out by the Office of Budget Responsibility alongside the budget on October the 30th. And the OBR will look at the full range of economic data right across the economy, including, of course, the information we've had this morning around debt now being at 100% of GDP. And it's on that basis the Chancellor will set out her decisions on October the 30th.
Chris Smyth, that sounds like a holding line to me.
It is indeed. And he is obviously right to say that estimates of the size of this boost and the estimates of, you know, what it means that the debt has gone up so much have been made by pretty credible experts. But the one that matters for the government is the Office of Budget Responsibility. So it won't be until they've made their assessment that the government knows how much cash it's got if it wants to meet its fiscal rules. And those forecasts will come in over the next month or so, and we'll basically decide how much pain we're all going to have to suffer in the budget.
Good to speak to you, Chris. Thanks a lot. That's Chris Smyther, the Whitehall editor from The Times, on that story of is there headroom, is it a black hole? That's what's going to be argued over as the economists and the politicians pick through the numbers. That'll be a big part of the debate at the Labour Party conference, which gets underway this weekend. We go to Birmingham now, where Reform UK's party conference has begun. Our political correspondent, Tony Bonsiore, is wandering around the conference centre. Tony, how are you?
I'm all right, Matt. How are you? Greetings from Brum. It's absolutely packed here at the conference, I have to say. I'm just outside with all the smokers. There's a few pints being sunk here as well. The party's starting early. It's quite an event. I think it's going to be pretty different, this, to what you can expect at Labour and the Tories in the weeks ahead.
I saw someone posted online that they're selling pint lanyards so you can hang your pint glass around your neck. Have you seen anybody with one of those on?
I haven't, but I'm going to be looking for that. My shift knocks off about 6 o'clock, and that doesn't sound like the worst idea. I am seeing people, Matt, with very ginormous pint glasses. I wonder whether they're more than that, whether it's some sort of statement here. But anyway, the speech has started at 12. I already noticed a few people having a kind of few cheeky scoops as they were starting. And right now we're in the kind of late lunch, I don't know what you call it. But it
liquid
does feel
lunch.
Like there's a couple of hours of liquid lunch, I think. I think it's going to be a long, productive, joyous day for a lot of these people.
And you've been out and about talking to some of them.
I have been out and talking to them. In fact, I was in a massive queue outside today because of security, trying to get a sense, really, of, you know, what brought people to this conference. This is what they had to say.
I'm just really interested to see what's going on and their views on everything, because I kind of think that Britain's broken, and concerned about my grandson, really, and what's going to happen in the future.
What would your personal priorities be?
There are so many. I mean, the NHS, the care system, more than anything, our military. There's so many, so many.
What do you think this party should be really focusing on?
I would boil it down into saying protecting the Britishness of the country. We're losing our tolerance under the pressures that having different cultures is giving us. We're losing our confidence in ourselves. We're ruining our economy with initiatives like net zero. And we want to get the country back on track. Some people who've really got a vision for what it means to be British are being proud of our heritage, not ashamed of it, and taking us forward with confidence and growing. At the moment, all our leaders are just pulling us apart, not being proud of our heritage, and leading us to a not very good future.
Right, what brings you here today?
Reforms policies, reforms enthusiasm. This country needs change. Politicians aren't listening. Reforms listening to the people. We gained a seat in our Thurrock. Change is afoot. Change is needed.
And really, I'm here as the beginning of a political party and wanting to see the change happening in the country. And also, what's just happened with Keir Starmer giving up the actual £300 heating benefit. Again, that is just totally against what he said and why we voted for the Labour in the first place.
Are you staying for the party tonight?
Oh, yes.
It's been a big year, right? You're at the bar with Nigel Farage. What are you going to buy him?
Oh, A week away with me. No, 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 not at all. I'm going to buy him whatever he wants to drink. He deserves a drink. What he's been through, he's been debanked. He's been vilified in the house. I'll give him a drink and a pat on the back.
I'll buy him a real ale from Wetherspoons across the road, because that's what he drinks. He doesn't drink the stuff that's in this building. It's all non-real ale.
Oh, dear, Tony, it's all non-real ale. That won't be going down very well. What does the rest of the day and the weekend look like then, Tony?
The rest of the afternoon, speeches from Lee Anderson, Nigel Farage and others this afternoon. Tomorrow it wraps up when they're going to vote on this new constitution to change the party, to turn it into what Nigel Farage says will be a mainstream political party. And then, of course, the centrepiece for it, I think, for a lot of people here will be the big bash tonight.
The big bash tonight. Good to speak to you, Tony. I'll let you get off and get yourself a beer lanyard. See if you can work out which code that goes on under your expenses. Good to speak to you, Tony. And then in about 5-10 minutes' time, we're going to speak to Richard Tice, Deputy Leader of the Reform UK, who's live in Birmingham. We'll speak to him after the news. But now, after the runaway success of the MMP this week, we need to draw some balls. Let's find. I'm looking for a 5 Live listener in every constituency in the country. So I will generate today's random 3-digit number. Here we go. Right. Let's have a different... Here we are. Oh, here we go. Let's have 3. Here's a number 3. We are going number 3. Another ping pong ball. 3-6. That's sort of mid-alphabet, isn't it? 3-6. 3-6-1. 3-6-1 is... Put that into the supercomputer... And it is Manchester Withington. Manchester Withington. Are you in Manchester Withington right now? Have you been there? Have you driven through it? Did you go on holiday once? Did you, as someone claimed this week, go to a wedding in the constituency and have a toothache? Your best claim to Manchester Withington, please. 08085 909 693. You can text 85058. Before the end of the show, we'll find the person with the best claim to Manchester Withington. You can come on, you can make your claim, and we'll send you a certificate. I've got the certificates. My homework for the weekend is to get them signed. So signed certificates and... Rosettes. Your best claim to Manchester Withington, please. 85058 on the text. 08085 909 693 on the WhatsApp. Up next, Richard Tice, the Deputy Leader of Reform UK, joins us live. And then Laura Koonsberg's here as well. But let's get a news update now from Richard Foster.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Lawyers for some of the 37 women who accused Mohamed Al-Fayed of rape and sexual assault say Harrods enabled its former owner. The billionaire, who died last year, has been described as a monster and a predator. Mohamed Al-Fayed also owned Fulham Football Club. It says it started an investigation into whether anyone there was affected by his behaviour. There's been more violence between Israel and Lebanon. The Israeli military says more than 100 rockets have been fired into northern Israel. The attacks follow intensive airstrikes in southern Lebanon. The Reform UK conference is underway in Birmingham. The party leader Nigel Farage will make a speech later this afternoon. Members will also vote on a constitution, how the parties run, policy choices and who gets to join. Matt will be speaking to the party's deputy leader Richard Tice in a few minutes. And hundreds of Sky Glass TV and streaming service customers have been reporting problems. Some of the TVs weren't working properly or even switching on last night. The advice is to switch it off and on again. Issues were still being flagged this morning. That's the news. Shojo has the sport.
Well, the champagne corks are popping at the Oval today after Surrey secured cricket's county championship for the third successive season. For the first time, any side has achieved that feat since Yorkshire in the 1960s. Their achievement was confirmed after their nearest challenger, Somerset, were beaten by Lancashire at Old Trafford today. Well, the Surrey head coach Gareth Batty says in a crowded cricketing calendar, the county championship still deserves to be celebrated.
We have the best domestic structure in the world and we've got to stop slating it and get behind it, because there's some wonderful cricket players, there's some wonderful people involved, and I think we need to champion it and keep moving it forward.
Emma Raducanu's quarterfinal at the Korean Open tennis has been rained off. She and Daria Kazakina will face off tomorrow instead, and the winner will need to come back on court to play their semi-final on the same day. Over on Sports Extra at the moment, you can hear second practice at the Singapore Grand Prix. Ferrari's Charles Leclerc was quickest in the first session.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Matt Shawley.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Well, good afternoon to you, actually, on a Friday afternoon. Now, we were just talking about the Reform UK Party conference in Birmingham. Well, we can go there live. The party's deputy leader, the MP for Boston and Skegness, is Richard Tice. Hi, Richard.
A very good afternoon to you in a hugely energetic conference hall here in Birmingham. I hope you can hear me. It's a little bit dull outside, but it's blooming and bursting with excitement and energy here inside. You should be here, Matt, not in the studio.
I'll be honest, all this talk of beer lanyards, where you can hang pints of beer around your neck, I would be there if I could, Richard. I'd be there if I could. We're 2.5 months on now since the general election. You won 5 seats, 14% of the vote. What's the priorities now? What does the next 5 years look like for Reform UK?
Great question, and already we're going up in the first polls produced across England, Scotland and Wales, and we're focusing now on the May elections next year, really important county elections, unitary elections, mayoral elections, and so we're out there campaigning, building up branch networks with a plan to build confidence, build enthusiasm, build professionalism, with a view to, we've got to be ambitious, and I know some people we'll say you're being overly ambitious, but I don't believe in that. Our plan is to win the next general election and to save Britain. It's as simple as that.
Now, you talk about that being overambitious. It took the Labour Party 23 years from being formed to forming a minority government. It took the Lib Dems 72 years to join a coalition. SNP took them 73 years before they formed a government in Edinburgh. The last time a smaller party's leader said, I'm going to be Prime Minister, was Jo Swinson in 2019, the leader of the Lib Dems. She went around saying she was going to be Prime Minister. She lost her seat. Is there a risk in being overly ambitious?
I'm not happy being compared to the Lib Dems in the nicest possible way. But, look, the reality is that the world moves much faster now. We've got the internet, we've got technology, everything's happening. And so, yeah, you know, you've got to be ambitious, you've got to be optimistic, otherwise you wouldn't be in politics. But look, the country's in a terrible state. Nothing works. People are getting poorer. The quality of life is reducing. And we've got a loveless landslide of a Labour Party. I launched the word Starmageddon back in January. Little did I realise it would be Starmageddon on steroids, impoverishing 10 million pensioners under free gear Kia.
Are you doing surgeries in your constituency in Boston and Skegness?
I am indeed, yes, and I enjoy them, meeting lots of people, businesses. I was in Boston and Skegness just yesterday and, you know, getting stuck in, very visible in the constituency. I've secured a property there. So, yeah, we're making great progress. People say to me that I've been seen more in 11 weeks than my predecessor in 9 years. I've spoken 16 times in the House of Commons in about 5 weeks of sitting time. So, yeah, I'm getting stuck in, you know.
Do you think Nigel Farage is getting stuck in when he's been to America 3 times
Absolutely,
since he was elected? He's not appeared in the House of Commons nearly as much as you. And then he says he's not holding face-to-face surgery meetings because of security concerns, and the Commons Speaker's office is saying they haven't told him not to hold in-person meetings.
Yeah, but the point is that Nigel is the leader of the party. I haven't been to America at all because, you know, I'm focusing here. I'm doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the chamber. Nigel is an international political figure, and with regard to America,
he's also the Clacton MP, Richard.
To be the next president. Hang on. But listen, if you want something doing, Matt, give it to a busy, successful person. The US is our most important strategic partner. It's absolutely vital that that next president, Donald Trump, has confidence in key political figures in the United Kingdom. And he has strong confidence in Nigel Farage, and that's in the strategic UK national interest. That's why it's absolutely right he's there. His team are doing lots of casework in Clacton, as are my team in Boston Skegness. Frankly, look, we're busy people. We don't sleep. We get stuck in. We work 24/7. I think I work hard. No one works harder than Nigel.
But do you think you say you want to replace all of the other parties and form the next government? Is Nigel Farage going to become Prime Minister if he spends more time in America than he does in his own constituency in Clacton?
Oh, come on. Listen, But where's Keir Starmer spending his time? He's spending his time internationally because he's the Prime Minister. So, look, I'm confident that our constituents of all five MPs, including Clacton, are delighted, actually, to have a high-profile MP who's out there in the national interest, getting stuff done, spreading important messages, spreading confidence that actually, although the UK is having a tough economic time at the moment, it's being badly led and badly governed, actually, we can turn this round. It's like having a good business that's being badly led under new, strong leadership from Reform UK. In the future, we can turn this country around. And my goodness me, it needs it.
We're talking of business. I can see you've got your merchandise stand behind you over your shoulder. It was reported
Absolutely.
This lunchtime...
You know, good commercial interest.
Good commercial interest, and that's how you're raising money. The Mirror reporting this lunchtime, you've got T-shirts with Save Britain written on the front, which have been made in Bangladesh.
Are they indeed? Well, I mean, no-one reads the Daily Mirror, so frankly, who cares? But, that's the reality. The message is strong. Save Britain. And
why not get a British T-shirt manufacturer to make the T-shirts?
A really good point. Actually, we've got loads of ties. They're made in Essex using British silk, I believe. Wonderful British ties with the British flag on. So, yeah, we're making great progress on that too.
Richard Tice, really appreciate your time today. The MP for Boston and Skegness, the party's deputy leader. Plenty more from the Reform UK party conference throughout the day here on 5 Live. I think Nigel Farage's speech is at 5 o'clock, so there'll be details of that on Drive. Later on today, so we'll bring you details of that later. From the Reform UK conference, we can now look ahead to the Labour Party conference. Laura Koonsberg is there. Are you, Laura?
I'm not there yet, Matt, but I will be there tomorrow.
I meant, are you there in the ether?
I am here in the ether. I thought you meant.
I didn't mean you there. Are you there, sort of putting out the chairs and bolting together the security fences? Yeah, very good.
What to expect? Well, here's the awkward thing for the Labour Party. This should be a massive victory lap. After 14 years in the wilderness of opposition, it should be the moment when Ellie Reeves is the first Labour minister to stride on the stage in 15 years to address conference as somebody actually in office. It should just be whooping and cheering like the Lib Dem conference, but much, much bigger and with no water sports. But instead, you know, they're going into this conference with a sort of classic, embarrassing story about the toxic mix of money and politics. And they're going into the conference with a lot of unhappiness over the biggest policy decisions that they've made so far. Namely, as 5 Live listeners know, the decision to take winter fuel allowance from the vast majority of pensioners. Now, Labour loyalists you talk to say, for goodness sake, we've done lots and lots of other things too. Look, we've just put a bill forward that nationalises the railways. We're getting going with changing the planning system so we could build houses. But there's no question that inside the party, lots of people you talk to are sort of, you know, sucking through their teeth a bit and thinking, this isn't quite panning out how we'd hoped.
And from a sort of journalistic comms point of view, Laura, it's one of those things where you sort of wonder why how it hasn't been shut down yet. You know, the great art of a spin doctor was to shut down a story, to sort of draw a line under it. And why they hadn't managed to do that before yesterday, when Keir Starmer did a whole round of interviews with regional political editors from across the country, where all of them, it seems, were asking about Sue Gray, about his Arsenal tickets, about money, about winter fuel payments and all of that. I think we've got a clip, actually. This is the BBC South East political editor, Charlotte Wright, asking the Prime Minister about the off-the-record briefings about Sue Gray's pay.
With all these briefings against you, are you the one that's in control here?
Look, I've got a team here at Number 10 and around the Cabinet table who are utterly determined and focused on the change that we were elected to bring about. We've already set up a national wealth fund. We've already started taking the first steps to reduce our waiting list. They're the things that the team here, that the Cabinet, the whole Labour Party government
there are people who are very unhappy within your team, and I'm wondering whether you've got a grip on that and whether you're the one in control here.
I'm completely in control and focused.
I'm completely in control. All the papers seem to have leapt on that answer, Laura, as an example of if you're saying it, there's a problem.
Well, that's right. And you just do not want, as any politician, to be in a kind of position where you might have to say that kind of thing, because the fact that it's being asked is a problem in itself. And, you know, quite a few people I've been talking to in the last few days sort of say, look, this kind of thing should be what's going on when a government's well, if not half the way through, maybe in sort of at the end of days, you know, when people are cross and they know they're on the way out, so they start leaking and they start chattering and they start gossiping and things sort of start going awry. I think, though, in a way, it's sort of the reverse of that. These are very public kind of teething problems, right? So the question is, how long is it going to be before the government, if indeed they do, tighten everything up, really, really get a grip, really, really understand how they're going to make number 10 work for them? How are they going to get government grinding into gear? And, you know, somebody, a powerful figure on the left of the party was saying to me yesterday, look, it feels to me like they're really struggling to get a grip of this in terms of understanding how government works. And it is a huge thing. You know, government is not ever easy. But it certainly is the case, I think, some of them have been surprised themselves by how they seem to have sort of slipped control, you know, of the agenda that's not quite sort of firing on all cylinders for them. But it's the first change in government for a very, very, very long time. And there's not that many people around who've actually done it before. But we're certainly a long way from, you know, a few months ago, all the briefing was, wow, we've done all this incredible preparation. Sue Gray's completely made us do all this hard work. We've got all this stuff ready to go. But then, you know, real life, reality, absolutely being in the spotlight and under the microscope with lots of scrutiny, that has got very uncomfortable for them already.
Yeah, and I think you're right. All the people I've spoken to in and around, you know, number 10 and the government more generally, there is this sort of slight sense of surprise. No matter how much people tell you it's going to be like this, it's not until you're really doing it that you actually experience it in real time. In fact, I was somewhere after, I don't know if you saw, Laura, that I confirmed my status as a serious political journalist by taking Ed Davey on a roller coaster this week. And somebody from number 10 messaged me after seeing me on a roller coaster saying, we've been on a metaphorical one for the past couple of days. And that was Tuesday. And I think it's fair to say there's been some ups and downs going round in circles since then. So looking ahead to the weekend then, Laura, who and indeed what have you got on your show on Sunday?
So, well, interestingly, we've got Angela Rayner, who is not just the deputy leader of the Labour Party, but is also the deputy prime minister of the country. She's coming on the programme. Interestingly, Matt, it's the first time ever that she has come and done a big interview on a Sunday morning on our programme. We've been on air for more than 2 years now, and it's the first time ever that Angela Rayner is the one being put forward by the Labour Party. So that's an interesting thing if you are a saddo like me, in and of itself, isn't it? So you, as a fellow nerd, you sound like you find that quite intriguing too.
Yeah, because she is, although she, you know, lots of people in the Labour Party see her as one of their stronger communicators. She doesn't do nearly as much media as lots of others. So it'll be interesting to see.
Indeed not. So interesting to see that. Yeah, and also for something completely different, you might, and I'm sure some Five Live listeners might remember the Karamurzas. So Vladimir Karamurza was one of the political prisoners locked up by Vladimir Putin for a long time. And on the programme a few times, we spoke to his wife, Evgenia Karamurza, who was campaigning like a lion for his release. I mean, she's an incredible, incredible woman who was fighting to get him out. Now, he was one of the prisoners who was released in that big prisoner swap not so long ago. And actually, I'm just in London at the moment, actually, before Liverpool, and we're about to do the first ever joint interview with them since his release. So we'll be showing that to people on Sunday as well. There might be a snippet of that on the news tomorrow. So that for something completely different, away from the fun and games and intrigue of the British political party conference season, that I think will be a very moving interview. I mean, you can only imagine what that family have been through. And this afternoon, we're going to have a chance to catch up with them and tell their story on Sunday.
You'll see something for everyone. Is it 9 o'clock Sunday morning?
Definitely. BBC One and iPlayer.
Fabulous. Laura, really good to speak to you. Laura Kuzbeck there telling us what? Giving you a little sneak peek, you see, of what else is coming up on her show on Sunday. And then I'm heading up to Liverpool later on Sunday, so we'll be there live Monday, Tuesday as well. So we're including bringing you Keir Starmer's speech in full on Tuesday afternoon. That's something to look forward to next week. Now, we're just getting in some news. Fulham Football Club says it has launched an investigation into whether anyone at the club was affected following allegations by multiple women of sexual assaults by their past owner, Mohamed El Fayed. Those allegations were made by ex-employees of Howard's, another of his former companies. Well, our sports news correspondent is Laura Scott. Laura, what can you tell us?
Well, we've had the statement through from Fulham Football Club.
Oh, can you hear me now? Yeah,
that's my fault. I hadn't pressed the button. Go on then,
we'll start again.
Yeah, thank you.
We've had this statement through from Fulham Football Club saying that they are deeply troubled and concerned by what they describe as disturbing reports in the BBC documentary concerning their late owner, Mohamed Al-Fayed. They say, we have sincere empathy for the women who've shared their experiences. Now, Mohamed Al-Fayed bought Fulham in 1997. He owned the club for 16 years, during which time the men's team rose from the third division in English football all the way up to the Premier League and into Europe. The women's team experienced mixed fortunes because in 2000 they became the first ever women's team in Europe to turn fully professional. But then in 2003 they were downgraded to semi-professional status, and in 2006 the club withdrew its funding for the team altogether. What we've heard today from lawyers representing women who accused the late billionaire of sexual abuse, they said that they aren't currently representing any women who previously worked at Fulham, but they say their investigations are ongoing into all the entities that he had an involvement with. And Fulham's statement says that they are in the process of establishing whether anyone at the club is or has been affected by the kinds of allegations we heard in the BBC investigation. And they say that should any person wish to share information or experiences, they should contact the club and the specific safeguarding department of the club, or indeed speak to the police. But what's clear is they are keen to establish whether there was anything going on during Al-Fayed's time at the club that they need to know about.
Thank you for that, Laura. Laura Scott there, our sports news correspondent. And as and when there are any other developments on that story, we'll of course bring it to you here on 5 Live. Right, coming up a bit later on, we'll also bring you the latest on the situation in the Lebanon. The Lebanese ambassador to the UK joining us on the show in the next hour. And we're also going to have another attempt at our quiz at first past the post. Can our reigning Prime Minister Gordon hold on in the face of a challenge? Now, let's return to our mission to try and find a 5 Live listener in every seat in the country. yesterday, if you weren't listening to the show yesterday, we had the constituency of York Outer. It was alphabetically the last constituency on the list. Now, Ruth, who was driving through York Outer, got the nod primarily, I made her the member of Matt's Parliament, MMP, for her description of the shape of the constituency as a stupid donut. Let's have a listen.
It's a newish constituency.
It's a newish constituency they've created around the outside.
Yeah. It's like a donut. It's really stupid. So I was just driving there and I heard you do all the, select the numbers and all this, and I thought, well, this convoluted. Is silly. Could be anybody. And then it said York Outer, and I thought, hey, that's me.
So, Ruth got it. However, others came in. Daniel and Howard, they stood for election, but they couldn't beat Ruth's admittedly tenuous claim to the patch. But we also had Marco on.
Oh, I'm sat in York Outer.
You're in York Outer right now?
Right now.
That is good stuff. And what do I need to know about York Outer? What do you do? What's your connection?
Well, first of all, I did hear, was it Ruth who was talking about it being a donut? But she should have known, that the Polo Mint was made in York.
Was it?
I don't know if it is now, but originally, we're a Polo, not a donut.
You're a Polo, not a donut. Oh, I feel bad, partly because I said I wanted some more women in the Parliament. Ruth, I think Ruth came first with the donut. I prefer donuts to mints anyway. Yeah, so I made Ruth the MMP, the member of Matt's Parliament. Now, since that call, which was right at the end of yesterday's show, my team have been relentlessly moaning at me for failing to point out that Marco was, in fact, this Marco.
Oh, it's Gabbiadini. He's got away from Palmer. Oh, what a good finish. It's 2-2, and Gabbiadini scores a brilliant goal.
Yeah. Marco, who came on to try and get a certificate and a rosette, is the former Derby, Sunderland and York City footballer Marco Gabbiadini. I mean, if he'd played that card, if he told me he played football for York, his chance of being the MMP for York Outer might be slightly better. Anyway, maybe he'll have some other claims to it. So today's constituency we're looking for is Manchester Withington. Manchester Withington, I drew the balls out at the beginning of the show. Debbie's on the line. Hello, Debbie.
Hello there.
Where are you right now, Debbie?
At the moment, I'm in Buckinghamshire.
Okay, that's quite a long way from Manchester Withington. What's your claim?
Well, I spent some of the happiest years of my life in Manchester Withington at Withington Hospital, where I trained to be a nurse from 1987 to 1990.
Very nice. Well, that's a nice job to be being a nurse. And where did you hang out when you weren't being a nurse?
Well, we used to go to the Red Lion in Didsbury. We used to get free curries in Rush Home because we were nurses. And we would hang out in Manchester at all the clubs.
Very good. Well, tell you what, stay there, Debbie, because Greg is on the line. Hello, Greg.
Hello there. How are you doing?
Very good. Where are you, Greg?
I'm just over in the Heatons, Heaton Mersey. It's like the next couple of bus stops along from Withington.
Very good. So you're in Manchester. You're geographically closer. Give me your
Absolutely.
Claim. Give me your claim to Manchester Withington.
Oh, steeped in Withington. My grandfather was a fire officer at Withington Town, Withington Fire Station during the war. Then me and my four siblings all grew up in Withington, just near the old house at home. We got great use of the local institutions, one of them being Withington Library, the other one being Withington Baths, and the third, already mentioned, a Withington institution, not Didsbury, the Red Lion, where I worked for, I think, 6 years pre and post being a student.
Hang on.
So what years? About the busiest pub in Britain.
What years are we talking about here, Greg? What years?
I was there from 1986, 85, 86, up till about 6 years later. So all the time that your other caller was probably having a few pints.
Debbie, was that when you were in there drinking?
It absolutely was. We probably knew each other.
Wow!
And I know, well, there's a long story there somewhere, I'm sure.
I'm sure there is. You probably bought me a drink at some point.
Or you might have tipped me for pulling you a decent pint.
Maybe.
Debbie, what is your memory of the bar staff in the Red Lion? Were they nice?
They were brilliant. They always made sure that we got our drinks first because we were regulars and we were nurses. So, yeah, they were absolutely
superb. You missed this nurses
superb.
Bit, didn't you? Get your drinks first,
I know.
Get your free curries.
Oh, then you get your free drink.
Yeah, they were always a good crew for an after-hours party, though, the nurses. So
oh, were they?
You knew which side your bread was buttered if you made sure you served the nurses first. No mistakes made on that front.
Matt, can I say that I also worked in a pub in Manchester?
Did you?
Yeah, near Manchester City Football Ground. It was a little bit rougher than the Red Lion in Didsbury. And whenever trouble broke out, which it regularly did, the landlord used to shove us down the cellar and we used to have to be locked in there until everybody had gone and
what?
We used to come and clear up the mess. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we never needed that sort of behaviour at the Red
Lion.
No,
it was a bit rough.
Well, it's because
it's
because you didn't upset the nurses. You didn't want them kicking off. They'd know exactly which spot to kick. What an amazing thing. What a nice little reunion to have.
Fabulous.
So what do you do now, Debbie?
Well, I eventually became a district nurse, and I also worked in palliative care, so end-of-life care. But I'd also like to add, because of my healthcare experience, I think I'd be a really good health minister in your cabinet, Matt.
Well, I don't have a cabinet anymore.
You're nudging there, Debbie. That's a good move.
It's the old show. It's the old programme. It's the old programme. Well, you'll have to come back and do the Prime Minister. This is such a good turn up for the books. Could you do a job share as the MMP for Manchester Withington?
I'd be up for that.
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't know if we might have to cut the rosette down the middle because we've only ordered 650. It'll really muck with the maths. What do you do now, Greg?
I'm a company director, but I work in healthcare, so I work pharmaceuticals and medical devices and all that. So working with nurses and doctors the length of
Well, maybe you're selling... Maybe, do you sell your stuff to Debbie?
I'm sure somebody at some point has. I used to sell her a pint of Guinness now and again, I think. Or maybe it was Marston's Pedigree. I don't know what your tipple was, Debbie.
No, it was cider.
What a brilliant... This might be my favourite MMP so far. I mean, we've got another hour yet. Somebody's got to be working pretty blooming hard to do better than finding two people who used to work and drink in the same... Is it still there, the Red Lion?
The Red Lion's still there. It's been done up a good bit since. It's not as quite as busy as it used to be back then, but pubs aren't really. But it's still going strong.
And what's
it's
what's
not the... far from Christie's Hospital, so the good staff of that
all the nurses in there, yeah.
Pop in and have a feed there as well. So
did you used to do food, Greg?
Still going. The pub did. I didn't get involved in all that.
What was it? What was it? Was it good food?
It was excellent food. It was old school bar food, you know.
Lovely.
You could get chili and half rice, half chips and stuff like that, you know. Don't see it anymore.
But you were having that burry, Debbie, because you were saving yourself a free curry for later.
Yeah. I wasn't really interested in the food. Yeah, it was more the more the drinks and the bar staff.
There we go.
Oh, my goodness. What a brilliant, brilliant call. Thank you so much for both coming on. That's Debbie in Buckinghamshire, Greg in Manchester. Stay tuned. You may well, you know, it's got to be pretty good to beat that. If you've got a better claim to Manchester Withington, you've got an hour to come on. You can text me 85058. You can call 08085 909 693. Or maybe you used to drink in the Red Lion pub in the late 80s, early 90s, and you remember Greg or you remember Debbie. And we can cut the rosette in three directions. Right, coming up. Brace yourselves. Adopt the brace position. It's coming.
First past the post.
Yeah, it's our slightly complicated quiz. It's coming up next here on Five Live.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio Five Live.
A very good afternoon to you. It's Matt Cholley on Five Live for the next hour. Yes, we'll play the quiz. Yes, we'll try to work out how Keir Starmer can spin himself out of his current issues. We'll take a look at the politics of the Tour de France and we'll hear from the Lebanon ambassador to the UK. All that after a news update from Richard Foster.
Thanks, Matt. Good afternoon. Mohamed Al-Fayed was a monster whose behaviour was enabled by Harrods, the department store he owned. That's the claim from lawyers who represent some of the 37 women who've accused him of rape and sexual assault. The billionaire died last year, aged 94. Gloria Allred has represented victims in numerous sex assault cases. She spoke at a news conference earlier.
Al-Fayed's legacy was to prey upon, denigrate, humiliate, and abuse female employees for his own sexual gratification. That is a legacy that no one should continue.
Harrods insists it's a very different company now and it's made a settlement process available to women who say they were attacked by Mohamed Al-Fayed. He also used to own Fulham Football Club, of course, and that they've started an investigation into whether any employees were abused there. Our sports news correspondent Laura Scott has more.
Earlier on in the press conference involving lawyers representing women who've accused the late billionaire of sexual abuse, the lawyers said that they don't currently represent anyone who's come forward with incidents or alleged incidents relating to Al-Fayed's time at the club, but they say their investigations are ongoing and Fulham have asked anyone to come forward to their safeguarding team and the police.
Other stories this afternoon, and Lebanese officials say Israel's carried out an airstrike on a Hezbollah stronghold in the capital, Beirut. The Israeli military says it was a targeted strike. Matt will be speaking to Lebanon's ambassador to the UK in the next hour. Public debt as a share of the UK economy has hit 100% for the first time since the 1960s. The government borrowed £13.7 billion last month, £3 billion more than in August last year. The deputy leader of Reform UK has told Matt that its ambition is to win the next general election. Richard Tice has been speaking as the party's annual conference gets underway in Birmingham. He says they've got big plans.
We're focusing now on the May elections next year, really important county elections.